Well, as you remember, hopefully, from a couple weeks ago, we started in the book of Esther. We were looking at women in the Old Testament, and so we decided on Esther first. Esther takes place time-wise during an era that much of the Old Testament doesn't refer to. So Esther's kind of in its own little time slot. This, of course, is when Persia is the world empire. The southern kingdom of Persia was taken into Babylonian captivity, was there for 70 years, and then the Persians overtook the Babylonians, and the Jewish people of that southern kingdom, many of them stayed with the Persians. Instead of, you know, they were allowed to come back home, the Persian kings let them come back home. But a lot of them chose not to. So they stayed in Persia. And so we have here two of them, Esther, and then we'll talk about Mordecai in a minute. They were both Jewish people who stayed in Persia instead of going back to Judah and Jerusalem. So that's the time period, that's the history of the world at this point. The Persians were not very what would be the best word? They let people go wherever they basically wanted to. They didn't keep them in certain areas, which was quite different than the Babylonians had been or the Assyrians with the northern kingdom. So that was something that was quite different. Remember last week we were introduced to King Ahasuerus, which historically was identified with the Persian king Xerxes, which is, we're talking about like somewhere 450 to 480 BC. So in that time frame. Xerxes at this point in time was having a lot of external conflicts with other countries, especially Greece. And basically between chapter 1 and chapter 2, he loses a number of battles. He loses a number of battles that figure quite importantly in the history of Persia. But we're introduced to him. He's the king. We see what kind of person he is. We talked about the feast that he threw and all that happened there. Talked about his queen Vashti and how he wanted her to, because of her beauty, to be paraded in front of all the other princes and so forth. And she refused. And so she was basically kicked out of being a queen. And so he decides to replace her and find another one. Now, it's in that time frame when he comes back from losing the battles, that's when he decides to choose a new queen. He's lost the battles, so now he comes back and chooses a new queen. And we began talking about that a little bit last week, but we'll go back to chapter 2, verse 1. It says, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel into the women's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. And so this is what happens when he basically comes back from those battles that he lost. And now they say, okay, let's get a new queen, basically to cheer him up, because he's lost battles. He's lost to the Greeks twice, at least. And Queen Vashti is out of the picture, so something that he really needs is a new queen. So usually, They would only go to a few of the prominent families in Persia because she was to be a Persian queen. But he was in basically such down in the dumps that they said, well, let's broaden the scope of who is chosen so that someone that's incredibly beautiful, incredibly charming, will be picked. And this we have to go back and say, well, we see God's hand in this. We see God's hand in this. Because normally someone from a Jewish background would not be chosen to be the queen of Persia. That would be just, not allowed. But it was necessary for a Jewish woman to be chosen, actually a girl, she was quite young when she became queen, a Jewish girl to become queen so that later on the Jewish people could be saved. So in every chapter and sometimes several times in each chapter, we see how the providence of God is working, working behind the scenes, using events and so forth to bring about his will. And that's certainly one of them. The deposing of Queen Vashti and then him looking for a new one that could be non-Persian. So it's really, Esther is even more amazing when you bring in some of the things happening in the Persian Empire. We see how God is working in so many different ways to bring about the desired result, which is what Esther is all about, is how God providentially worked through several people, through several events, through several nations, Greece and Persia for sure, to bring about his will. And so when we think about it in that sense, we see God's hand just everywhere. So that's what they're doing. They're picking out or getting people to come together. And then we're introduced to a new character, verse 5. In Shushan the citadel there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. A Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So here's the new character, Mordecai. Very importantly, he is from the tribe of Benjamin. And again, I think we see God's hand because the tribe of Benjamin plays a very important role in this series of events. We look at that and we see the word Benjaminite and we don't think much about it. But that's a huge part of the account. And it plays a very big role in what happens between Mordecai and Haman, because Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin. That's why I say there's so many little things in this account that's just amazing, really. And that's about the best word to use. So, Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And she was probably, as I mentioned, very young at this time. I mean, some of the references were thinking 15, 16, 17 years old, 20 maybe at the max, 20 or 21. So she's very young, okay? She's very young. Services start at 7. I didn't know if you were aware of that or not. That's still echoing, David.
Yeah, I know. I've turned it down twice now. You want me to just turn it completely down?
Well, just turn it down a little bit more. Maybe I'll move this down. Maybe that'll help.
All right, try it now.
Okay. Maybe it'll stay that way for a while. We're in Esther chapter 2, down about verse 7. So we see the relationship between Mordecai and Esther. He had taken her and was basically raising her as his own, for the most part. Took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and that command and decree were that they were to go out into all the lands, not just certain families, but all over, okay? And this was going to take quite a long period of time because of their communication process. So they're looking, he's looking for a new queen. And she doesn't have to be Persian this time. Again, God's hand is working in this. So, when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. So along with all the other women that were kind of hand-picked, she is hand-picked as well. So she's in amongst this big group. It doesn't say where they're all from or anything, but apparently that was a very large group from all over the empire. Now the young woman pleased him as she obtained his favor, talking about Haggai. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. So when these young women were chosen, they were all given certain ointments and preparations and so forth to make basically themselves as beautiful as possible for the king. And they all had the same allowance, the same amount. Well, she found a lot of favor with the guy that was in charge of all the women. So because of that, he gave her extra above and beyond what he gave all the others. Okay. Again, I think we can see God behind a number of these things happening. So then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So not only did he give her extra ointments and preparations and perfumes and so forth, he gave her 7 basically of the best maidservants, and then gave them the best house. So she was really kind of coddled, in a sense, above all the other women, okay? Which certainly plays into the account as we go along. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. There was going to be a place and a time when it was going to be revealed. But here at the beginning was not the time to do it. So Mordecai had told her, again, she's essentially a young girl, okay, probably late teens. So he was basically in charge of her, telling her what to do, kind of guiding her, okay, along the way. And it told her, you know, don't tell people where you're from yet, okay? How different did she look than the rest of the people? Hard to say. I mean, most of the people were apparently from Persia, but there would have been other nationalities there as well. Did the Jewish women look all that much different than the Persian women? Again, it's hard to say. But anyway, he told her, and it may have been for a number of reasons, I'm sure they were good reasons, not to reveal where she had came from. So, and every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. So it was like he had stationed himself right there at the front door of where the women were stationed, so he would learn immediately. And he would hear everything about Esther and how she was doing, how things were going, did she need anything, so on. So he was very, very concerned about her welfare and if everything was going right and so forth. Again, this was like a daughter to him. So he was, it kind of like had adopted her. So he was very concerned for her. So each young woman's turn came to go in to King Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation. This was a long ordeal. This was a very long ordeal. Each of them had to wait 12 months before they could even go in to see him. So it was, like I said, it was a long ordeal. And there might have been a lot of reasons why they had to wait 12 months. One of them might have been to make sure that they weren't with child. that would have ensured it. But there might have been other reasons on top of that as well. But anyway, there was a long time of preparation. Also, some of the women had to get used to Persian customs because they came from other areas, other nationalities, so they wouldn't have known a lot of the Persian customs, of Persian food and Persian everything else. So that 12 months was a preparation time in a number of ways. According to the regulations for the women, for thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. Whatever it was that she thought would be the best thing to take with her, she was allowed to take. So in the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So this was like a one-time opportunity. One time. And then, after that period, then she went to another house. Not the first one she'd been in, but a different one. And so there were like two different houses for two different groups of women. And this was, if you read Persian history, it was pretty common. It was pretty much how the royalty in Persia during that period lived. Okay, now when the turn came for Esther, remember they all had the times of preparation and they would each go in and so forth. Came for her turn, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. Remember, he had really treated her special. So it was her idea that because he had trusted her or had treated her so nicely, that he would know better than anybody the best thing to go to take with her. So she trusted him to take, you know, whatever he suggested, because she was like his favorite. So, and Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So she obviously was someone who was not only beautiful, but was charming and had a wonderful personality, and people just liked to be around her. Okay? So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And we're introduced to him, I think it was like in his second or third year. So, you know, 4 or 5 years have taken place between chapter 1 and the end of chapter 2. So a number of years have taken place. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Again, I think we're seeing God's hand, because it was very important that she be placed in a position of authority, really, which is what it was, because she would be the only one allowed to see the king, because there was only going to be one queen. There could be a lot of concubines possibly, but only one queen. So it was an important position, and it plays out to be a very important position as you go on and read what happens, because if she hadn't been in that position, then the Jews might not have been saved. So we see that her being in this position, that King Ahasuerus, you know, finding favor with her, was an extremely important point in the story. So, so the king made a great feast. He was fond of feasting. I mean, he was fond of feasting. This guy liked to throw big parties all the time. The feast of Esther. So he named it after her. For all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. So he was very, very impressed with Esther. Was so glad that he had found Esther, that someone had found her and brought her and to be part of the group of women. So he was extremely happy. So he throws this big feast for all these different people, and you know, gave gifts and made it a holiday, and Esther Day. We have the word yesterday today, but yesterday is not really a holiday. When most people don't get my jokes, by the way, at least my freshmen don't. It's rare, very rare. When I have a co-teacher, him and I'll laugh, no one else will laugh. Unless I say, that was a joke, then they'll laugh. Then they'll see something funny. So when the virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Again, he's right out front, always wanting to know how things are going with his adopted daughter. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. All of that extremely important in what happens in the book. All of that very important. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So even though we only have like a couple little verses about this, he basically unearths a plot. He hears about a plot to kill the king. And so he tells Esther. Esther tells the king the plot is foiled and this is done in his name, because later that will have a huge role. Very, very important role to play in the salvation of the Jews. And that's kind of what Esther is about. How the Jewish people were saved, because the Jewish people had to be saved for the Messiah to come through them. So after these things, we have a little bit more time. King Ahasuerus promoted Haman. Now we have another, what are they called in place? Protagonist introduced, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. So we have this new character. Now, he was an Agagite. He was, Agag was one who was king of the Amalekites. And so Haman is a descendant of him. And where is it? First, back in 1 Samuel 15... This Agag was, and the Amalekites were one of Israel's bitterest enemies. And so this is what I'm saying about the fact that Mordecai was a Benjaminite, and this guy was an Amalekite. Those two were bitter enemies for years and years and years. And there had been this almost hatred between them because of the Amalekites trying to kill the Israelites. And especially, this was through King Saul, who was a Benjaminite. So all of this kind of fits together. Okay, it all fits together so amazingly. You see God's hand in it again. So these two, Haman and Mordecai, you can see, if you've read the rest of it, you know how Haman hates Mordecai. And their peoples, their ancestors, have a lot of enmity between them. So it goes back many, many years. So this Haman was promoted, I guess is the word. And he was basically second in command. So right below King Ahasuerus was Haman. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Mordecai wouldn't basically bow down and worship him. All the others did, but not him. So you can imagine how Haman hated to see Mordecai. Because every time he'd walk by Mordecai, Mordecai would just stand up straight, not bow, not anything. So it just made Haman angrier and angrier and angrier. So then the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened when they spoke to him daily and he would not listen to them that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told him that he was a Jew. For Mordecai had told him that he was a Jew. So Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage. Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews. Now remember, going all the way back to King Agag, they hated the Jews. They hated the Jews. So his deal was, I don't want to just kill Mordecai, so that's just killing one Jew. What I want to do is I want to get together some way and make a plot where I can kill all the Jews and the world will be rid of them forever. So that's what he's plotting. He's trying to find out or figure out a way not only that Mordecai will be killed, but every single Jew in the entire Persian Empire will be killed. That's what he wants. And of course, if that happens, then there would be no one for the Messiah to come through. So that's like that's the struggle that's going on in the book of Esther. How are the Jews going to be saved? And we kind of reach a climax toward the end of the book. So we still have some more time. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, now we're in the 12th year. Okay, so we've, between chapter 1 and chapter 3 now, we're about 10 years have taken place. They cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So they cast lots to determine, okay, when are we going to bring about this plot to kill all the Jews? So they cast lots, and it came up with the 12th month, which was a long ways down the road, which, again, I think we see God's hand in that, that it was going to be a long time before this plot was supposed to come together. So that's when it fell. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it's not fitting for the king to let them remain." Can't you just see the deception in this guy when he's talking to the king? There's this people. Their laws aren't like anybody else's. And they don't keep your commands like everybody else does. So we shouldn't let them remain. Let's get rid of them. So, if it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. The Persian Empire, especially at that time, was the emperor was fond of giving decrees about everything. Gave decrees constantly. That they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasury. Ah. Now he says, you know Haman's thought about this for a while. He says, maybe, you can just see the little wheels in his mind going, maybe just telling the king that these people don't obey his commands might not be enough. But if I throw in a whole bunch of money on top of it, then surely he will agree. So, greed. Now, some of the treasury for the Persian Empire, at least from the history that I read, some of the treasury were getting kind of low because they'd spent all the money on these battles against Greece, and they were needing money. So, when he hears about 10,000 talents, which in today's money were, you know, millions and millions of dollars, that was probably the icing on the cake for the king. So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you." basically saying, as long as you give me the money, I don't care what you do or how you get rid of them. I'm just wanting the money. So he did it for the money. I don't think from reading he could care less whether they were following his commands, but he was really needing that 10,000 talents of silver. So we'll just go to the end of the chapter and then we can be done. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. And the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month. Okay, now the decree went out on the 13th day of the first month. So we're basically talking about almost a whole year before the decree was to become valid. To kill in one day on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. Of course, this was really how Haman was going to be able to supply 10,000 talents of silver. He was going to kill all the Jews and take all of their money and possessions. I mean, this guy was devious. So a copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. When that day came, then they were basically given permission, anybody was, to kill any of the Jews. It was like free rein. On that day, you can kill as many Jews as you want to. No repercussions, you're not going to be charged with any crime, nothing. You're allowed to kill the Jews on that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. See, the only people that really knew what was going on was Haman and the king. All the other rulers and the people in the city couldn't figure out, why in the world are you giving this to decree to kill all the Jews in like a year from now? Why are you doing that? So the people couldn't figure it out. It didn't make any sense to them. And I'm sure that's the only time in history that the people didn't understand what the government officials were doing. But that's what was happening there. And people couldn't figure out why in the world the king had made this law. It didn't make any sense. Well, there were only two people that knew. That was why. Only two people. So in chapter 4, the plot thickens even more. But we'll have to wait. We'll have to wait.
You can't go on?
My throat's already wearing out.
Really?
I gave too many people homework recovery after school today and stuff. It was a rough day at school. I know. If you have a chance to read chapter 4 before next week, please do. It's like I said, the plot really starts to thicken. We see more of God's hand behind everything. Before David leads us in an invitation song, I want us to think about how many things had to happen for Jesus to be born, when he was born, where he was born, the circumstances in which he was born. Just think about the things we're seeing in the book of Esther that God had to work with and manipulate so that all of these things would happen at the right time with the right people in the right place so that Jesus could be born in the first part of the first century in Judah, in Bethlehem, outside Jerusalem. It's amazing when we see God working. But he really started working, the Bible says, at the very beginning. Because he knew, you know, the Trinity knew what Adam and Eve were going to do, and that there was going to have to be a plan of redemption that would all center around Jesus, him coming into the world, like Galatians talks about, at the right time, dying on the cross at the right time, in the right place, and being resurrected. But before that could happen, countless numbers of small things had to happen at just the right time for all of that to come about. And that has to be the most amazing amazing account ever about anything, is following all of those little things that had to happen just like they did so that we could have a Messiah. Causes us to think, doesn't it? Well, tonight, if there's any need for you to respond, whether it's to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, to ask for forgiveness, to ask for prayers, whatever the reason, we encourage you to come as we stand and sing this song.